It's time now for Setting the Record Straight on KOHI with Melinda Bernard. You can call the show now at 503-397-1600 or toll free at 877-397-1632. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KOHI, staff, management, or sponsors. Now, here's Melinda.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Setting the Record Straight. Happy Friday. It is a glorious day. And Carol and I have a great show ahead for you. Our first guest this morning is Rick Stagenborg. Rick is, he's quite a guy, very accomplished individual. Rick is a retired physician, but he today is here talking to us about public banking. Should we have a public bank? What would that mean for citizens, and what would that mean for industry? Well, we're going to talk about that with Rick this morning. And Rick, I just want to thank you again for taking the time to join us. Welcome. And tell us about the Public Banking Alliance and what that means and how you got involved with it.
Sure. And thanks for having me, Melinda. The Oregon Public Banking Alliance is, I'm not sure how long it's been around. I got involved a couple of years ago when we were trying to establish something called a municipal public bank, which is a way that cities would be able to take the funds they have, the tax revenues, and put them into a bank that would serve a public function rather than primarily serve the function of profits, generating profits for investors. So any public bank, whether it's a municipal bank or a state bank, has that function. It's set up by a state or municipality, takes those funds, and uses them like any bank does to make loans up to 10 times what their operating capital, what their available funds are for lending. In other words, they keep some reserve, but for those funds, they can lend up to 10 times as much. And this
is huge.
That's what banks do.
So if you have $10 million, you can loan 10 times $10 million.
That's right. It's called fractional reserve lending.
Did you know that, Carol? You're on mute. Carol's on. Okay, she's getting there. I did not know that. Carol, try again. Are you on mute? Okay. Okay. Well, credit unions.
Okay, now I am.
There you are.
I've got two devices going at once, and I was unmuting the other one, but it wasn't helping. Fractional reserve lending?
That's right.
I got to write this down.
Fractional reserve lending.
Never heard of it. No.
It goes way, way back. Back when money had to be backed by gold, or back when gold was the currency, even, the people that owned the gold were started lending out about 10 times what they actually had because people didn't tend to come in and want it all at once. So they realized they could do that, so they did. And they started issuing paper certificates as notes, and that became the first kind of paper money.
Oh.
That's called fractional reserve lending, and banks are still allowed to do that. And more.
Wow.
Private banks can create money out of thin air, but public banks can't.
So how does this dovetail with public banking? Would a public bank also be able to do this, or are they limited?
They would be able to do fractional reserve lending, yes, and they'd be required to follow all the prudent banking practices that big banks don't have to because they're too big to fail. So they're also safer.
Public banks are.
They are, right.
Okay. And so how did you get involved? I mean, what drove your interest in public banking?
Oh, my gosh. That was a while ago. But one thing is, I mean, during Occupy, there was a lot of publicity about what all the banks were doing and all the shenanigans they were pulling because this was after the 2008 crisis. Mm-hmm. So I guess I kind of did a deep dive at that time into the way banking works. Not that I'm an expert. I'm not going to claim to be an expert. But it made me realize the criminality of the big banks, big national banks that have so much power in Washington that, you know, they tell the government what to do instead of the other way around. So that was my main motivation for wanting to work for this. But the fact is, these banks are so beneficial to the public that, you know, even if it weren't for the fact that big banks are basically criminal enterprises, we'd want this because there's a return on the investment, and the money is there when you need it for infrastructure projects, especially, which are a tremendous burden to small communities like St. Helens. I don't know if you guys have had any infrastructure projects in the last 10, 15 years or whatever, but if you look at the cost of a 30-year bond, 40 to 50% of that goes to interest and fees.
So when a municipality like the city of St. Helens or the county of Columbia County, what do they do with their money? I never really thought about it. Do they put their money in whatever bank they choose to, or a credit union? And if this public banking alliance, if public banking were a thing here in Oregon, they could put their money in the public bank and maybe have lower interest rates?
Well, that's a couple of different questions. My understanding is that 90, I can't remember the exact percentage, but in the high 90s, percent of government funds are in the big five or six banks, because they can handle that volume, especially the bigger cities. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know about St. Helens. St. Helens might be able to put all or part of its funds in the largest local banks or credit unions, but I think it might be big enough where that even St. Helens, they couldn't even handle St. Helens. So there's a real need for this, and obviously Portland, Beaverton, the bigger ones, Eugene, probably Albany or Corvallis, which aren't that big, would have, they have to go to those banks because they can't get the services. But they get less money back for putting their money there, which the bank can then use to generate a profit. They get less back for interest. They get probably roughly what we get on our savings account.
Well, yeah, that isn't good. So this, the Public Banking Alliance has a bill. They put together a bill, and it's in the House, House Bill 2763, and it is the sponsors, a lot of sponsors, Representative Gamba, and there's Senator Golden, and lots of representatives. I don't see a single Republican on here. It looks like it's all Democrats. And basically, this bill, House Bill 2763, would establish a state public bank task force. And it is, what do you think about this bill? Is this something that you would support?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was involved somewhat in crafting it. Obviously, I wasn't working directly with the legislators involved, but I was involved in discussions with the people who brought it to the legislature. So I'm absolutely in favor of it. To your comment about having no Republican backers, I don't think that's going to be the case by the time it comes to a vote. But we are actively looking for Republican backers. This should not be a partisan issue. I mean, it makes no sense. It makes so much economic sense that anybody who's fiscally responsible, or for that matter, anybody who's profligate and wants more money to spend, should support this bill, because we're talking about billions of dollars that can be saved by the state municipalities.
Well, let's talk about this for a second. According to this bill, if passed, the president of the Senate would appoint one member from the majority party and one member of the minority party of the Senate, and then the Speaker of the House would do the same. So that's four. So at least 15 members. So this is a huge task force. And this is calling for a member with management in a credit union, management of a cannabis business, which I want to come back to, management of a community bank, a member with experience in farming, and then there's representatives that have to be from the metropolitan counties and the Federal Office of Management and Budget. I mean, there's a lot of specifics in here. Also a representative of the Oregon Public Banking Allowance. And this is the one that I want to talk about first. It requires that a current or a former representative of the Bank of North Dakota be on the task force. Do you know why that is?
Yes, I do.
What's special about North Dakota?
Well, it's the only state that's instituted the state bank.
Oh.
And amazingly, it did it over 100 years ago.
Wow.
And so it has a long, long track record of excellent performance that generates a return to the state in the form of dividends. By the way, the state doesn't operate the bank. The state establishes the bank, figures out a way to capitalize it. And then the bank operates with a board of professional directors. Bank of North Dakota has outperformed private banks in terms of its return, especially during the banking crisis in 2008, mm-hmm. 2009. Because it wasn't invested in derivatives, it was invested in projects that actually produced a return to the state itself.
Okay.
And the State Bank of Oregon would do the same thing. It would keep the money in Oregon, the money that comes from our taxes, to be used to make loans in Oregon that would then generate some profit for the bank, and that could be returned, part of that could be returned to the state as a dividend. So they wouldn't own it and operate it, but they could still get dividends. Now, that's not true if the bank were capitalized through private capital, which is a possibility. They would not be able to take dividends. They would have a guaranteed return, a different thing. So they wouldn't have any motivation even to try to mess with the system if it were possible.
Okay.
There's a lot of safeguards to keep either politicians or private interests from messing with its operations. That's why Bank of North Dakota is backed by, it's a very red state now. When it was first instituted, it was a very blue state as part of the populist movement. Nobody would touch the Bank of North Dakota now that they see how well it works. And so that's why we want a representative with that kind of experience on the board.
Okay, that's fascinating. I know that there were farmers banks once upon a time and a similar model. So let's talk about why this bill is calling for somebody to be a member that has experience in the management of a cannabis business.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're probably aware that those people, they have some real motivations to want to be in there. They want to pay their taxes. I mean, these are businesses, and they could be put out of business if they don't pay their taxes. But they can only pay in cash because the federal government doesn't allow them to use banks. So it's a very dangerous thing, and there have been recent articles about the degree of violence involved in people trying to get their hands on all that money, that, you know, just cash laying around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very dangerous thing. It's not good for public safety. And as long as it's a legal business, it's not right, in my opinion. It shouldn't be able to operate like any other business.
Oh, agreed. I think we've talked about this on our show, right, Carol?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But doesn't the federal government supersede Oregon? I mean, what if we did allow them? I mean, aren't the feds going to come down on us?
Well, they haven't come down on businesses other than to make them operate in this very unsafe way.
True. Okay.
And this is, yeah, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. We do have a banking lawyer in our group, but that question's never come up, so I can't really say.
Okay. So then the other, there were some other interesting people that would be a requirement to be in this or to be involved in the work group, and that is a representative of the Oregon School Boards Association, a representative of the American Federation of Teachers, the Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, somebody involved in the council trades. So what would unions have, why would unions be involved in this work group? What's the benefit of that?
Well, because when those loans are made out for infrastructure projects, it means union jobs.
Okay.
Well, it means jobs. In Oregon, sure. That generally means union wage jobs, if not union jobs. So that's why they want to be involved. Why do the teachers want to be involved? And, well, there'd be more money for education, potentially. There'd be more money for whatever the legislature determines is a priority, basically.
Okay.
Or, I mean, of course, and some of that could be in the form of reduction of taxes, theoretically. We don't know. That's all speculative.
And so, Carol, you had a question?
Yeah, but you want to finish yours first?
No. Well, okay, sure.
Yeah.
So how would this bank differ than any other bank? If they're allowed to do fractional reserve lending, and I'm guessing that is a lot of that is based on collateral, if you're doing home loans or, like, car loans or whatever. How is this public bank differing from, let's say, you know, one of the big guys?
Well, they don't have to divert funds to pay shareholders or multi-million-dollar CEO and executive salaries. So there's that. Number two is they don't have physical buildings, so it doesn't cost nearly as much money to operate. The way it works is they would actually work with local banks and credit unions to backstop their loans so they can make bigger loans. And if, you know, if necessary, they can make a loan themselves. If, say, a huge infrastructure project in Portland or something, not that this would be dominated. If you look at the list of dominated by urban interests, if you look at the list of people on the board, it would actually includes lots of representation from rural areas, like farmers, because mm-hmm. farmers also are getting taken advantage of by the big banks in the same way they were when the Bank of North Dakota was established. Like you said, there were farmers banks and then there was the Bank of North Dakota.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Carol, thank you.
So this is fascinating. One of my interests is campaign finance. And one of the things that I have and several people, I'm in a lot of groups where we're dealing with things like this, is that somebody from Texas is making all the decisions about what happens in Columbia County. And part of it is who lends the money. I mean, you look at Oristar and you can see who's calling our elections, who's making the decisions about who's going to be a port commissioner or whatever. And that's the kind of thing that's upsetting, because there's not a lot, you know, most of us don't have the money to fight that. So I'm very excited about this. I think it's a great idea, and so glad that we're hearing about it. Thank you for getting on that committee.
Absolutely. So my next question, in Section 3, let's see, under the bill, it talks about, in addition to the other duties, the State Public Bank Task Force, that's a mouthful, shall explore the potential benefits and harms of a state bank engaging in lending, payments, or providing other public financial infrastructure, and there's a whole list of things. And what caught my eye are two things: agricultural loans to incentivize sustainable farming practices, and student loans. So can we talk about student loans for a second?
Sure.
As a parent of children who have enormous student loans, I'm appalled at what they want to charge young people to take out money. It's ridiculous. It's outrageous. And a public bank, would that be for people who are citizens or residents of Oregon, but maybe they go to school in another state? How would that work? Because our next generation is going to have a huge debt load, and we're never going to get out from under this if they don't have any sort of avenue. So what about that?
Well, as to your last question, I can't really answer it. I don't know how it works in North Dakota, which is the only one that that does student loans, because it's the only state bank or public bank in the United States. But this is a good example of where things get complex and why we need a task force to sort things out. So it is possible because North Dakota did it, but they did it by establishing the bank under a certain model, and there are different models that you can use, and this is where it starts confusing me too. But it has to do with whether you can make loans to individuals or even small businesses. It's possible because North Dakota does it, but then you might need to get FDIC insurance, whereas you might not have to otherwise. Now, FDIC insurance is very expensive. It involves a whole lot more whole another layer of regulation, and it may not be worth it if you can avoid it. So that's a kind of trade-off that the task force is going to have to look at, because you're right, that is a huge problem, and that is one of the reasons why, frankly, I'd like to get rid of the big banks entirely.
Mm-hmm. Well, also under Section 3, it calls for a depository for community credit unions and community banks. So if a local credit union, and St. Helens was built on a credit union. I mean, it was the driver, the economic driver way back in the day. And so if they were given money at a low rate to then in turn loan to students, they already have to have, the credit unions have something like FDIC. I can't remember what it is, but it's not exactly FDIC. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting. But really, the other one is to incentivize sustainable farming practices. So this is going to be a very interesting task force. Sadly, this bill seems to be in limbo, like many of the bills currently in the legislature, because it started in the House, and it looks like it's been referred to Ways and Means, and it's been assigned to the Subcommittee on General Government. And if it passes out of there, it still does have to go to the Senate. And as we know, the Senate isn't really operating currently. So have you heard any update on this bill at all, Rick?
I haven't heard anything behind the scenes, and I'm not sure I'd be at liberty to say if I had. But that is a conundrum that everybody's facing. But one thing that gives me a lot of hope that this particular bill can pass is, number one is, as I said, there's absolutely no reason this should be a partisan issue. And number two is, it's a very cheap ask. This task force is composed mostly of volunteers, and we estimate that the total cost would be maybe $200,000. Basic costs in staff time is about $184,000. And then if all of the volunteers working on the task force claimed mileage and other expenses, that might add another $40,000-ish.
Right.
So maybe $220,000 max. So it's a cheap bill for the potential. It's like a no-brainer. I mean, I really hope that it's a matter of getting the word out and making our legislators understand this. And that's what the Oregon Public Banking Alliance is doing right now, literally, the second on this show, getting the word out and encouraging people to let their legislators know, their state legislators, this is critical. This is something that can save us very soon, because if you look at the instability in the national banking system, we really don't have any choice but to do something different.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And I can see that would be tremendously effective, especially for small communities that do need infrastructure projects but can't afford the huge lift. Or the voters, we just passed a bond, two bonds in this community, one for a sheriff's levy to support new deputies, and one to get matching funds for a high school. But if it was a huge infrastructure project, which no doubt one of the cities in this community is going to need, if they could get a lower rate, then it wouldn't cost the taxpayers as much. So I think, it's a win-win. Anyway, we're going to have to take a quick break. I just want to thank you so much, Rick, for hopping on and sharing this really interesting topic with us. Please come back and let us know after the legislature has concluded its business what happened to this bill. Hopefully it's going to make it through. Hopefully the senators are going to return and do their job, but that's a story for another day. So Carol and I are going to take a quick break, and we are going to be right back. We're going to be chatting about another bill called the Right to Rest. We'll explain what that is when we get back. This is Setting the Record Straight Stay with us.
Need towing? Call Grumpy's Towing, 24-hour emergency service, providing jump starts, winching and recovery for autos, trucks, to boats. And Grumpy's Towing is equipped to service large trucks to semi-trucks. Grumpy's Towing is here to give you prompt service, and they work with most insurance companies. When you need help, remember Grumpy's Towing. That's the name for 24-hour service. Call 503-543-5533. Grumpy's Towing, 503-543-5533. 13 Nights on the River is back June 1st, so get ready for a great time every Thursday night with your favorite bands from 6 to 8 p.m. and your favorite food with vendors and more starting at 3 p.m. Party on the River at Columbia View Park on the St. Helens Waterfront. 13 Nights on the River is sponsored in part by Wana Credit Union, Cascadia Home Loans, Best Western, the Jane Garcia Team, Keller Williams, Big Food Cart and Brew, 503 Distilling, and the City of St. Helens. So, see you at the river every Thursday night this summer, starting June 1st. Get more information today at discovercolumbiacounty.com.
13 Nights on the River.
Ahoy, adventurers. Escape your screens and set sail aboard the Lady Washington. Adventure is calling. To find her schedule and the nearest port, visit historicalseaport.org today. All aboard for a journey back to when tall ships ruled the seas.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little.
It's Setting the Record Straight on KOHI with Melinda Bernard. Call the show now at 503-397-1600.
And we're back. Carol and I are chatting this morning with Ariel Knox. Ariel is the founder of Morgan Group, which is a business group. And we're talking about another bill, and actually a movement, I guess is a better way to categorize this. And it's called the Right to Rest. And Ariel, could you explain that for us? What is the right to rest?
So the right to rest is essentially allowing people experiencing homelessness to have respect and dignity. It's allowing them to lean against the wall when they're tired, when their feet are killing them from walking around town all day. It's allowing them to fall asleep on a park bench, just like an office worker might take a power nap out on that park bench. But if you're experiencing homelessness, this has become a criminalized thing. We've found all of these ways to dehumanize the people experiencing homelessness. So there's many different aspects too. A lot of people focused on just, you know, whether or not you're kneeling, which, you know, there are religious affiliations where some of them need to kneel during the day, but now they're on the ground and they can be rousted and they can be harassed. Another really key part of this bill is the ability to give and receive food in public spaces again. As we've seen throughout the state and the country, it's been criminalized. You can't go give out food. You can't receive food in public parks, and that's absolutely ridiculous. I see pictures all the time of the legislature members, the legislators, that they get gift baskets from the different people that are bringing in food to their offices, and they have a home and a well-stocked fridge and pantry. But I can't give a granola bar and a water bottle to somebody who is sitting on the ground and it's 100 degrees out.
Wait. Where can't you do that?
There are a variety of city parks in different areas. In Salem, it was a big deal. This is legislation that's been passed in a variety of areas across the country where they're, you know, and now they've extended it to even if you're standing in line to vote, you can't be handed a water bottle, right? Like,
sure. But in Oregon, can you not do that? In Salem and Portland?
Yeah. So I know specifically two parks in Salem, that became a big problem. The other thing that this legislation would approve is I live in Kaiser, and in Kaiser, if you have a recreational vehicle on your property, you can't let someone stay in it. People can only sleep in it up to 30 days per calendar year. So if you have an uncle or you have a child who's experiencing this, you can't let them park a camper in your backyard out of view of everybody and let them have a shelter where they're bothering nobody. And so that's another thing that this would address, is allowing those of us who would like to help, allowing the people that do have RVs but have nowhere they're allowed to park them to sleep in them. And then another very important thing is what happens when you get rousted is you lose your belongings. Your stuff gets thrown away. You don't have the same protections against search and seizure. So if you cobbled together a backpack and you went to Kinko's and got a resume and you're trying to get your life together, they throw all your stuff away. You're starting over literally from nothing again. And it's just, you know, it's untenable. It's people lose their houses in wildfires and we all rush to the rescue and we donate stuff and we get them into housing and we waive fees for the paperwork they need and birth certificates. And that doesn't apply if you're already houseless. So,
okay, I noticed that, so your group, the organizers, and you, and some other groups that formed a coalition, is this correct? Correct me if I'm wrong. And went to a legislator and said, can you please address this with a bill? And it became House Bill 3501.
So originally this bill was introduced in the 2021 session, and it was up for public hearing, and that public hearing, I think, lasted something like 6 minutes. People had traveled, people had arranged for people experiencing houselessness to travel to the Capitol to testify and talk about it, and they pulled it with everybody there and sent them home. And so this bill is very important to Representative Chaichi because she was involved in that effort. So it was reintroduced this year, and while we understood that there were, there's opposition to it, there, and certainly every piece of legislation goes through, you know, amendments and you tweak things to get them just right, it deserved that public conversation. It deserved to let the people, you know, who had gotten squashed, their voices squashed the last time, to come have that conversation. And unfortunately, Fox News, The Five, and a bunch of very dishonest publishers put out a bunch of, you know, ginned up all this outrage of like, oh, well, you know, this means they can camp on your property and you can't do anything. And because another part of this bill, it talks about, and it's important that we look at the exact language, but it talks about harassment. If these people, if people experiencing homelessness are harassed, and this became, oh, you can't even yell at them or tell them to leave. Well, no, the bill specifically says that harassment means a knowing and willful course of conduct directed at a person experiencing homelessness that a reasonable person would consider serious, alarming, tormenting, or terrorizing of the person. So let's think to those images we've seen where it's the dead of winter, it's freezing cold, and someone goes and throws ice water on somebody who's sitting out on the curb who has nowhere to go get dry, no other clothes to get into. That should be a problem. That needs to be addressed. That should be something that someone can do something about, because these are people. Mm-hmm. And with COVID, with everything we've seen, with the explosion of, you know, how many people we have, 500,000 people at least homeless in the country right now. We're the richest nation on earth. What are our priorities? How many of these folks are disabled, are veterans, are families? And, you know, so then you start thinking too, what about the children that see their parents being treated like this? How does that affect their psyche? It's inflicting generational trauma.
Absolutely. So I'm looking at, and for those of you at home, if you ever want to look up a bill in the Oregon State Legislature, you can just go to olis.oregonlegislature.gov and type in the bill number. So that's olis.oregonlegislature.gov. And right now I'm looking at House Bill 3501, and I can see that it was introduced on February 28th, referred to the Speaker's desk. Then, like a week later, it went to Housing and Homelessness, and then where it languished for almost two months, it looks like, and then they canceled the public hearing. So are you saying that all of this backlash caused the Democratic folks who really are running the House and Homelessness to cancel the public hearing?
Absolutely. And a lot of it, there were something like 2,000 public comments in opposition and 47 in support. But that was, you know, we had Breitbart writing things that completely twisted what this was. And, you know, they're, oh, people, again, they made it out to be people can obstruct walkways. No, that's covered. That's not a, you know, you can't block human or vehicle traffic where you're doing this. But again, like, if you are experiencing homelessness, the odds are it's somewhat visible, right? If you haven't been able to take a shower, if you haven't been able to change those clothes, if you're layered up during the winter, we can, you know, see that sometimes. And so literally leaning against the wall is mentioned. The right to rest means specifically sitting, standing, leaning, kneeling, squatting, or lying on the ground or other surface. So, you know, I do bring it back to the people that do want to kneel to pray, that do, you know, need a power nap because they've been riding the bus to stay warm and, you know, all of these things. And where else are they supposed to sit? Where else are they allowed to lean against a wall because they've been walking all day?
Mm-hmm. Carol, did you have a comment? It looked like you had a comment.
Yeah, I'm just glad that you're doing this, Bill, because I think it's important, and it's amazing to me how this whole issue of the houseless people is being used politically. And, you know, we had a case here in St. Helens recently where the governor came to visit Columbia County and was touring the parks, and it got out through the dirty, weird press that she was looking for parks to put Portland homeless people in, you know, that kind of thing. And both Melinda and I listened to one of the city councilors had a forum, and, you know, how upset people are, and it's being used for politics. It's not being used to prove how totally uncaring we are as a society, but it's sure looking that way. Mm-hmm. And I can remember back in the day when Reagan came into office and all the institutions were closed for a while, shut down, and everybody congregated in Portland, which is where I was living then, and no place to go. What do you do with them? And it was an amazing thing to have to deal with, and I ended up getting hired to help public servants try to get these people some place to go. What do you do? What services should? And it's just I'm glad you're doing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, and my partner brought up a really good point when we were talking about me doing this interview, and I do have to say I still feel bad. So he'd accidentally locked the keys in the car when he was out shopping, and my phone was off, and so he had to walk from Salem to Kaiser to come home to get the spare key and have someone, you know, drive him over and get the car unlocked. And he said, you know, his feet were killing him, and he has good shoes. And, mm-hmm. You know, he was walking differently, but he was concerned, and he said he really did on that day and since then notice the people that, you know, of course you need to lean against a building for a while. Of course you need to sit down for a while, you know, but where do you sit when they've tried to, you know, we've done all these things. We've put rocks out under overpasses. We've put spikes in front of businesses. We've created all of these ways to make sitting down in public difficult, as if this is going to fix homelessness.
Thank you for making that point. You know, it used to be after Carol just mentioned in the 80s when they closed all the institutions, basically opened the doors and they bussed them to Burnside. Well, people were like, okay, I can ignore this. It's just a small amount, you know, and as the situation has grown, it's a worldwide epidemic. Worldwide, people cannot afford housing. And we can no longer pretend like it's not in our backyard and that it isn't affecting our communities, no matter where you go. And I thought it was interesting when you see people who need help, and really we don't have a place to put them. We have to do the hard work, and this is the hard work. This is saying, yes, I understand we have a problem, but instead of it being, you know, people who are terrible and deserve this lifestyle or whatever versus quote-unquote good people, we have to come together as a society and recognize this is a problem and we need to address it. And I'm very sorry that this bill didn't even get a public hearing. That seems very cowardly to me. Yeah, Carol?
I just wanted to add, years ago when I was working for the police department, helping them find resources, I had a young cop call me and he said, there's this woman here She has no place to go. You've got to find me a place. And I started, well, start aging services. And he said, she looks like my grandmother. I am not going to leave her even if I lose my job. And, you know, we need that sense in people. And it's hard to find. And too bad we need more of them, I guess, in the legislature. I don't know. That's just
humanity, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, caring about, these are people, and many of them are mentally ill, many of them are drug addicts or whatever, but we have to care. These are people. Anyway,
right.
That's it. My rant's over.
Well, let's talk about that piece of this bill, Ariel, that addresses people living in trailers. I understand that in our, you know, perfect suburban world or ideal world, you know, there won't be, you know, motorcycles on your lawn, and there wouldn't be extra trailers and people living in them. But I will tell you, in rural areas like the one that Carol and I currently live in, that is a reality because their homes are filled and these are relatives or friends who need a place to stay. And at some point, we're going to have to understand that the life that we knew as a society, we're not probably going back to. We need to go forward and decide what we're going to do. And so if we're not allowed to have ADU units, or I guess that's redundant, you know, or just have those extra housing, or we're not allowed to have, even on property, to have somebody living in a trailer, then what are we going to do? What are we supposed to do? Just pretend like this whole group of people don't exist? I mean, it makes no sense to me.
Well, and I lived in a very, very rural area. The town I grew up in, it finally reached 800 people. It has its own Wikipedia now in Fieldbrook in Humboldt County, California. And we were building a house, like literally the family built our house. And so there was a 2-bedroom trailer on the property when we bought it. And my sister and I didn't always get along. So my parents bought an RV, and that was her teenage bedroom. And that was just the way of life, right? And I'd go to bed at night, and I don't know why my parents had me unplug her at 10 o'clock every night, but it was a thing, right? But, like, I thought it was cool. She had all these beds, and, you know, she stored her record collection in the little oven. And so when I moved here, and, you know, I specifically mentioned uncle because my children's great uncle was experiencing homelessness and wanted to put his RV in our backyard while he got on his feet, and I found out that I couldn't. I found out that I could get in trouble for it. And I'm a big rule follower in certain aspects of my life. So, you know, I didn't. But yeah, like you said, these dwellings, and I've seen there's some really amazing pilot projects that they're doing in Seattle where they'll build up two tiny homes with the understanding that you're going to rent them out to people that are getting, you know, as transitional housing. And then after 5 years, they just become yours. And I'm like, sign me up. You put four back there. Like, let's, you know, so when people say not in my backyard, like, I'm literally saying, yes, in my backyard, I will house people. And I can't. And it's the, you know, another thing with the Humboldt County situation, and we talked, you know, people were very outraged when the immigrants were flown from one state to another by Governor DeSantis. But for Humboldt County at one point, someone went on a Craigslist in Redding, California, and told everybody that Humboldt County was doing a pilot program, which was kind of true, and they literally bussed all of the homeless people from there out to the coast and dumped them off.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's just, how do you, I mean, this is what dog, you know, you're rounding people up and dropping them off in the woods? Like, how
is
this okay?
It's not very 1940-ish, if you get my drift.
Yeah.
So now what? You know, House Bill 3501 is dead.
Right.
And as are probably most of the bills that are even made their way to the Senate, as
right.
we know. So what now? Where do you go from
so
here?
So what's next is on June 1st at 1 o'clock, we're having a protest in support of the right to rest. I personally have tagged on the right to rest and receive because I do think that food and drink aspect is a really important thing. You know, to eat, share, accept, or give food in any public space in which having food is not prohibited. My oldest daughter carries around little baggies she puts together in her car with, you know, items, a little bit of dog food, and that's her thing is if they have a pet, she'll stop and give them that. But she lived in a conversion van and was driving around the country, and in some places, not allowed. And it needs to be in writing, on the books, that it's okay to do, and that you can't arrest someone for trying to give out some food. You can't penalize someone for accepting food.
So do you anticipate further legislation in other sessions?
I hope so. I hope that this is brought back up, bring the people to the table that had the issues with it that are in good faith. There was, a lot of the opposition was basically trolling. If you watched the 7.5 minutes on the Fox 5, which personally I sat through once and I can never look at it again, but I mean, the absolute, the guy on Fox is saying, oh, people that are homeless are happy and they want to be homeless because they're sick and all of these things. And, again, it comes down to their belongings, these illegal sweeps. And I do have a gentleman that I have not stopped thinking about in 4 years. I was in front of the Salem Carousel 1 year. I used to be the gal that went around with that big llama. If you've ever seen Cesar Vinodrama Llama.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that was one of my projects. But this guy came up, and we often had homeless people that would want to come up, and I would see the looks that other people would give standing in line, and I would just take the homeless person to the front of the line and let them meet the llama first. But he told me his story, and he had, he had a PhD. He and his wife moved out here. They sold everything, moved out here, and she left him for someone else. And he had his resume and he had all of that, but it had been under the bridge because he couldn't carry everything and it got swept and he had nothing left. And he's just like, I don't know how I'm going to stop this cycle. Because mm-hmm. he did use the services available. He did get a change of clothes and he did get his resume done up and all of those things. But, try to imagine job seeking next time you have a family member that's looking for a job and now say, okay, but you can't shower or change your clothes or have a printed resume that isn't wrinkled up. Good luck. Go to your interview.
Right.
So that's the other thing. We need to do better about accepting the people where they are and helping them transition. I actually used to supervise homeless people in a job that I had doing outgoing mail for the Department of Human Services in California. And one of our coworkers worked his way up from one of, back in the day, general relief, you got like $350, but it required community service time. So they put in their hours and they cleaned parks and they did different things like that to help them work and get back up on their feet. And I saw it work and I saw how amazing it was all gentlemen at the time, but I saw how amazing these gentlemen were. We had one that had to carry his heart pills with him all the time and I would tell him, I'm like, Thomas, You could be exempted. You have a, and he's like, no, I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to get back on my feet and I want to earn it. And, that's what I think about people that are experiencing homelessness. And we need more people to see them as their brother, as their classmate, all of those things. This is somebody's baby. I have two friends that are largely missing from my childhood. They show back up for their children occasionally, maybe once or twice a year. My goddaughter just had her first baby and her mom couldn't be found to be there. And I would put them in an RV in my backyard right now if I was allowed to.
Sure.
I'd move them upstairs, but.
well, tell us about the organizers and what are, Is organizers just, you're the founder.
Yes.
Is it just focus on homelessness issues or do you have other?
No. So organizers, I actually started out, it was Salem Community Organizers. It was started when I attended, the Families Belong Together rally at the Capitol back in 2018. And, shout out to Bill Burgess, Marion County Clerk, who came up to me and my 15-year-old and was like, oh, you guys should stay involved in politics. I wound up on his campaign, met a llama. It went from there. But we do amplification. That's what we're good at. I'm disabled. I know how lucky I am to not be homeless. I know how incredibly lucky I am. And I can't donate my dime, so I donate my time. And so we focus on, civil rights is the main focus. But, we were part of the coalition to confirm Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court and things of that nature. So the other thing we try to do is show new activists the ladders that we've found to different tables and paths that we've discovered. And we've worked with a lot of really great people in the state.
That's amazing. And so going forward, do you think that a lot of your legislation will stay with Representative Chai Chi, or are you hoping to get a larger coalition?
I'm not sure at this point. We've only had one bill that we were largely involved with successfully passed, the student parent data collection bill, in the 21, I think it was, session. A lot of it, like I said, is simply finding the people that want to do the work and showing them who to connect with. It's facilitating, it's mentoring, and then from there, it's amplifying. So, you know, we're trying to be foster parents to the activism world and be like, here you go. Here's where, you know, where people are scared. They get nervous about meeting an elected official and, you know, hey, they're humans too. They're watching, Obama was at home watching Game of Thrones just like you were.
Right. So. That's amazing because I understand it can be very intimidating. Carol has been a longtime activist and troublemaker, so she is an old hand to this. But especially, we live in a smaller community, and I feel like our representatives have in the past been held to a higher standard. You cannot go to the grocery store without somebody recognizing you and coming up to you. That is not the experience in Portland, and I think that maybe that should be the experience. I think that everyone shouldn't be beholden or be, let me see, that's not the word, but your constituents should be able to know who you are, and I mean not harass you, but to say, hey, you know, I'd really like you to take this on or X on. And I realize that there's a lot of reasons why bills don't get heard. But just to drop a public hearing, that's very, very disappointing. So I am sorry to hear that. And kudos to you and to, you know, the rest of your coalition members who have worked so hard to bring all of this forward.
Well, and a shout out to Keith Haxton, who's really been the driving force behind this happening and is arranging that protest as well that we're helping with. So if you're able to come down on June 1st, the Capitol Park, 1 o'clock, and voice your support, talk to the other people, form coalition to come at this even stronger the next session.
Okay, and who was the person you said, Steve Paxton?
Keith Haxton.
Keith Haxton?
Yes.
Okay. And is Keith a member of the organizers, or is that?
No, Keith is actually a legislative assistant.
Okay.
In Rep. Chaichi's office, so.
Okay, that is great. That's great to know. And, Carol, we have, and I just want to say, Errol, we do have just about one more minute left in the show. And is there anything else that you think our listeners should know, or anything that maybe they can do to enact change locally?
Find a way to use your voice. It doesn't have to be an email. It doesn't have to be a phone banking. It can be a social media post where you tag your legislator. You can follow them on social media and comment on the things. I do social media training. So, find that way to make your voice. And like you said, don't harass them. But if you see them and you disagree with something they've done, talk to them about it. Let them know. And I mean that for both sides of the aisle. Even though we feel like there's no point talking to the other side of the aisle sometimes, they do need to hear from their constituents.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time. That is it for us, and also to Rick Stagmorn. And that's it. Everyone, thanks again. Make it a great week, and this has been Setting the Record Straight. Have a good one.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little.
You've been listening to Setting the Record Straight with Melinda Bernard on KOHI. Listen again next Friday here on AM 1600. You can email the show, kohi.radio@gmail.com, or email Melinda, strsradio@gmail.com.